Our next case is 12-2156, State of Ohio versus Christopher Richmond. Once Mr. Regas goes over to the appellee's side, Mr. Martin.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court, John Martin on behalf of Christopher Richmond. Chief Justice O'Connor, may I have 5 minutes for rebuttal?
Sure.
Thank you. This case can be resolved, as can the Amos case, through an opinion, I would suggest, that does the following. One, adopts as syllabus law the proposition of law that we have put forth on behalf of Mr. Richmond. When neither party requests the preparation of a pre-sentencing investigation, a trial court's felony sentence of community control sanctions will not be disturbed on appeal in the absence of the most exigent circumstances. In effect, the plain error test. And the idea there would be simply that, as a matter of appellate procedure, if you don't object, it gets reviewed on plain error.
And if that were the extent of our opinion, then on review, if it turns out that the defendant had a lot going on that would have been revealed to the court through a PSI that wasn't, then that is that the exigent circumstances or not? And how does one get that into the record if you're the prosecutor?
Well, first of all, if the prosecutor wants that PSI, or if the prosecutor has allocuted at sentencing, neither of which occurred with Mr.
Right.
Richmond, then it may be that the prosecutor would say and would allocute things that would cause a reviewing court to say, you know what, in this case, the trial court abused his or her discretion because in light of the information that had been brought out, sometimes it may have come out during a trial, because you can have a PSI, you can have a felony five sentencing after a trial, not just on a plea. And it may be that it came out during the trial. It may be that it came out when a victim stood up and said something. There could be a myriad of ways that a court of appeals would, in certain cases, say, guess what? This is plain error. This is the type of situation where a trial court, even though the state sat on its rights, even though the state did not object, the trial court should have ordered the PSI. Now, the second part of this court's opinion, I would suggest, after adopting that as its syllabus, would be to admonish lower courts to obtain a PSI in cases where they are going to impose a community control sanctions, or alternatively, procure a waiver from the two parties. Traditional waiver analysis, that when two parties agree to this procedural shortcut, then the shortcut can take place, and there's no issue at that point. So what we have so far, in the opinion that I would suggest to the court that it can write, is one, a recognition of forfeiture, plain error, in terms of the state's failure to ask for a pre-sentence, and B, telling courts, look, in the future, let's not get to that point of plain error. Best practices say, ask for the waiver up front. And at that point, if a party's not willing to make a waiver, then at that point, their chances are they're going to be putting forth on the record why it is.
Counselor, are we being realistic here, though? If we were to adopt the rule you're advocating, isn't there just going to be a form generated by every prosecutor's office in every case saying, PSI requested, thank you very much?
Your Honor, I would suggest to the court that no matter what you decide today, prosecutors, if they want to go that route, are going to stand up in court when they're there at the sentencing and say, I want a PSI, if in fact they want to be that strident in terms of how they want to proceed. And we can't stop, I can't stop, prosecutors from taking that position.
Well, can you think of any situation where a prosecutor would not want a PSI?
Yes, Your Honor. You could have a situation, first of all, consistent with a prosecutor's responsibilities pursuant to Berger versus United States and all the other cases that talk about it. The prosecutor's desire to do justice, prosecutors can, in my opinion, and do, in my opinion, recognize at times, either off the record or on the record, that this is a case that doesn't need prison. This is a case where community control sanctions is appropriate. And accordingly, there would be a number of instances where, as part of a plea agreement, for example, that maybe the prosecutor has agreed, you enter this plea, we're not seeking jail. Or we're not, I'm sorry, that was a misstatement. We're not seeking prison. And to that end, in those kinds of cases, a prosecutor may very well say, Your Honor, you've got a file in front of you. It's got a Leeds report inside of it, perhaps. You have responses to our discovery that included the defendant's record or lack thereof. You have a myriad of other, maybe you had a psych report in this case at one point, pre-trial as part of a competency evaluation. There could be a number of things, Your Honor, that we're not anxious to spend valuable state resources in order to prepare a PSI. And reasonable and responsible prosecutors not only should do that, but in my experience, they do that.
Mr. Martin, it seems to me that you're asking us to resolve a problem that was wholly created by the 8th District Court of Appeals. We've just heard from Mr. McGraw that they've decided the case one way in his clients, Mr. Amos's case, and now here. And there's some reliance on Nash, which is also a creation of the 8th District Court of Appeals. Why don't we let them clean up their own mess? We're not here to handle their internal problems. This isn't a statewide problem. It's a Cahoga County problem. Why don't we just tell them they have a duty to en banc and resolve this problem? Well, why should we wade into this?
Well, Your Honor, of course, Mr. Richmond asked for en banc review to begin with. My request for en banc review was similarly denied. That having been said, the problem—
So both lawyers in both cases recognized a conflict, and both asked the court to do it, and the court just said, no, we're not going to.
Your Honor, the court did rationalize its denial by saying that there were two different standards employed by the two courts.
But it's one court, isn't it? It's two panels.
Two panels.
With one judge sitting on both panels.
Yes, Your Honor, that is true. What I would say to the court is this. Do I think the two judgments are in conflict? Absolutely. I think the two judgments are in conflict. You got two cases where there was no PSI, one case, no objection with respect to this by the state of Ohio, and in one case, I'm sitting on this side of the table, and in the other's case, the state's sitting on that side of the table. Yes, there was a conflict. But now that the case is here, I would suggest to the court that sending it back for the 8th District to engage in the en banc review process is not necessary.
Counsel, I assume in further answer to Justice O'Donnell's question, you want us to overturn those opinions from other districts that say you can't waive. It would not be a harmless error analysis. It's contrary to law because a PSI is mandatory.
Your Honor, I don't know of, and it may be in one of the cases that the state cites in its brief, and if so, and I've missed it, I apologize. But I don't know of cases that have ever said there cannot be a waiver. In other words, you know, the waiver, the intentional relinquishment of the right to a PSI by the state of Ohio, is to my, I'm not aware of a case that has said, state of Ohio, you cannot do that. That is the extreme position that the state of Ohio takes in this case, and I think it's wrong. And indeed, it is contrary to this court's jurisprudence that recognizes that even a right as important as the defendant's right to allocute is a right that can still be subject to a harmless error standard of review.
Well, help me apply the Kalish analysis in this case. Would you agree that that plurality opinion should be, it should be a majority opinion, that we need to say that Kalish applies? That's where I'm having trouble with your argument. Kalish would have us look at, first, is it contrary to law? And let's say we decide a PSI is mandatory, it is contrary to law. So you go to the second prong, which would be abuse of discretion. Is that where you would say it's not abuse of discretion in this case because there was no objection? So in that second prong of Kalish, you apply a harmless error analysis. Do I have that right?
Your Honor, I think we could take it one step further. I think with respect to the first prong of Kalish, okay, the sentence in that the PSI is a means to the end, in that the PSI is a procedural vehicle by which the court imposes a sentence, I would suggest to the court that the PSI does not rise to the level where its absence creates a Kalish contrary to law argument. Contrary to law will include things like where there's substantive defects. The substantive defect, for example, of two sentences on allied offenses. A substantive defect such as the failure to make findings with respect to consecutive sentences, where the statute has made clear this sentence in and of itself requires those findings part and parcel in order to be valid. But the PSI, something that must be considered according to 32.2, but not something that creates any substantive requirement of this finding to support this kind of a sentence, I don't think rises to the level of the first prong of Kalish. That having been said, if you get to the second prong of Kalish, then I would suggest to the court that under an abuse of discretion standard, it is not unreasonable or arbitrary if a trial judge has proceeded without a PSI in the absence of a request from the state of Ohio or from the defense.
So you would agree that under your scenario or what your proposal is, that if the state wants a PSI, the state gets a PSI. There's no discretion on behalf of the judge to order that or to not order that.
If the state wants the PSI, then, and the trial court still does not order it, then the only way, then you have to review this, then you have to still review this as you review my trial objections that were overruled for whether or not the error was still harmless. Okay, so this, you still have a harmless error analysis. So if the state says, Your Honor, I want a PSI, and the trial court says, I'm not going to give it to you, then the state needs to say, well, Your Honor, then I want to proffer why it is that I want the PSI in this case. I want access. I'm sorry.
So, Mr. Martin, would you accept Mr. McGraw's arguments regarding placed on probation or placed on community control being separate from a community control sanction, or that distinguishing point that he made in his argument?
I never like to disagree with Mr. McGraw, and I never like to be the person in the courtroom who's not taking the most defense-oriented position, but I do respectfully disagree. And the reason why is that Mr. McGraw's statutory analysis, I think, is spot on, but 32.2 does not say placed. 32.2 says imposes community control sanctions. If 32.2 had said placed as well, I think Mr. McGraw would be correct. But because 32.2 uses the term imposes community control sanctions, I think that I have to respectfully disagree with him in this regard. I would point out that...
But it's not necessary to get to that parsing of the and your suggested resolution here. That jail and fine is not really a community control, or it is a community control. It, the definitions that we're struggling with here to try and fit fine and local jail time, that is not a substitute for prison time, local jail time, that's the struggle. How do you characterize that within the definitions that are contained in, the statute?
2929.15 sets forth, and I don't have it in front of me, but 2929.15 sets forth the community control sanctions, and it then references 2929.16, 17, and 18. And in referencing 16, 17, and 18, excuse me, it references the statutory provisions that include local incarceration and include financial sanctions.
You agree that sentenced to time served is a community control sanction?
Yes, I do. Because the sentence is to 30 days in jail, and then by operation of a different statute, you're required to give time served for that sentence. That's the reason why the judge cuts to the quick when they say, I'm giving you a sentence of time served. But what they're really doing is saying, I'm giving you a sentence of 30 days, and then by statute,
The time that's already been.
So time.
Yes, Your Honor.
So time served and fine. You're saying that if the state would request a PSI, the judge would have to get a PSI? Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that if the state requests a PSI in a case where the judge has made it clear that he or she is giving time served and a fine, that the trial court errs in not getting one. Now, on appeal, that would be subject to harmless error still, because all errors that are not constitutional in nature, and even many that are still subject to a harmless error analysis. But in these two cases, you never even get to the not harmless error standard because you can't get past the plain error standard because the state was silent.
But in answer to Justice Lansinger's question, if the judge says time served and fine, goodbye, and you're saying the Cuyahoga County or a prosecutor's office can say, yeah, but we want a pre-sentence investigation, isn't that a meaningless, useless document at that point since the case is already concluded?
Well,
what possibly could the judge do if all of a sudden somebody bursts into his courtroom 4 days later and said, this is a very bad person?
If the sentence has yet to be journalized, the sentence can still.
All right, 7 days later.
Well, but if that request
or 30 days later, as the practicality is, 30 days later, now we get this document of somebody who's already been sentenced and freed. Can the judge bring him back and say, I've rethought this?
No, if the sentence has been journalized, this court decided in State versus Carlisle that the trial court's jurisdiction ends at that point to modify the sentence. You'll recall that in Carlisle, there were serious health problems that wanted a judge to change.
So what possible value could that document hold at that point?
Well, the only possible value comes if the state has made a request and it goes up on appeal, and then the case gets remanded for a resentencing because the Court of Appeals determines that the error was not harmless.
New evidence after the final appealable order?
If the case comes back for a new sentencing because of any error at sentencing.
So you just resentence with the benefit of a PSI at that point.
Right, and the benefit, if that PSI included newly discovered evidence, that could come up. That can come up, and that can sometimes inure in both directions. Sometimes you'll get a prison sentence, and then by the time you get to a new sentencing for lack of findings or whatever, there's new mitigating evidence that causes a judge to reconsider. The court's been very indulgent. I know I've gone over time. If there are any questions, I would briefly conclude by saying that the last aspect of this court's opinion might very well be, after admonishing lower courts, is to say to the Rules Commission of this court, we need to look at, especially because HB 86 has now talked about how we want financial sanctions as the only possible sentence when appropriate, we need to look at 32.2 again. It needs to be revisited in light of the changes that have been made to the revised code. But don't disturb and don't change the plain error standard because it's much bigger than this case.
Thank you. Mr. Regas?
Mr. Regas, help us understand the process. As I listen to this unfold, and I realize you have a huge volume of criminal cases in Cuyahoga County that confront the judges. Mechanically, in a lot of cases, maybe in most, there's discussion between defense counsel and the prosecutor as to outcome, discussion of entering a plea and all of that. If a PSI is going to be helpful and even helpful to the prosecutor in deciding what outcome you might agree to, why can't you have a mechanism that gets it started quickly so that when you get to the stage that you were at in these cases, it's already done?
That's an interesting question, because the problem there, and I would say I would love to have that information. I would love to have the defendant's statements, the defendant's social history, without spending a lot of investigative resources. I would love to have the benefit of a mental and physical and a drug test on that. But I don't think the defense bar would allow or provide that information prior to a finding of guilt to me.
What about a bond review?
I don't think that would be practical.
Counsel, doesn't a lot of that stuff come in when a bond review is being done, when a bond is asked? Isn't there in Cuyahoga County, is there not a mechanism for a review of the defendant, the record, the circumstances, the drug involvement, home,
Yes, we do, but it's a cursory level. The defendant does not need to participate in that at all, and there's no outside look at school records. There's no outside look at other factors. There's no outside, there's no input
than the prosecutor. What I'm thinking talking. Is you're dealing with all different levels of crimes where you have serious offenses charged and perhaps disputes as to whether or not the defendant did it. That's one matter. But when you have what I assume was correctly recommended, represented to us, that you have cases like the first case, the Amos case, recurring or occurring all the time, there it would seem that it would be in the interest of both sides to not have Mr. Amos set in jail another 30 days while a PSI is done. So do you really think that the defense bar would object?
Yes.
Across the board?
Yes.
So the defense bar is going to object to getting this done timely and up front, and the prosecutors are going to object to waiver at any time. So, boom, we've got a head-butting situation across the board. No room for compromise.
Well, the room for compromise, we do that. We do discuss prior to coming to the court with any resolution or agreed sentence. We will do that. That's not
That's
uncommon.
What I assume.
But, yeah, of course, I don't think that's an issue in Cuyahoga County. I want to point out, and I know one of the justices mentioned, Justice Lanziger, you mentioned the culture. Well, I think the culture throughout the state is a plain reading of the statute. You don't go to community control without a PSI. And I was hearing talk about waiving that requirement. And in my experience, the defendant will waive the request for a PSI knowing that there's going to be a prison sentence imposed. So, I apologize if I didn't address that earlier, but I think the culture has always followed the plain language of the statute. It's required a PSI prior to placing anyone on community control. And I think this case and the prior case need to be resolved by this court. And the reason being is that in Amos particularly and in this case, Kalish was used. The standard of review of Kalish was used. Under Kalish, there's the first prong is to determine whether or not the sentence was contrary to law. And in this case, the state had a right to appeal under 2958.03b2 whether or not the sentence was contrary to law. The only definition—
And it's contrary to law because you didn't have a PSI?
Yes.
Okay, and you heard Mr. Martin saying that the PSI is a tool to get to the sentence. It's not part of the sentence. So how do you equate that? I don't understand how you capture the PSI and put it in the same category as a contrary to law sentence.
Well, under Kalish and in paragraph 14 of Kalish, this court in that plurality said that it's first looked to determine whether all applicable rules and statutes have been followed by the trial court. Here, this is a mandatory duty in both the criminal rule and in the statute. The court shall do this.
And then if we interject the ability to for parties to agree to waive this, what does that do to your argument?
I don't think it changes my argument at all. I still think it's a mandatory duty. And if there's not an explicit waiver on the record, then the court still has that duty. That and again, I think that duty is not it's for the benefit of the public and the court's information to impose a proper community control sentence. It's not a benefit to the state per se. I can argue about how bad a defendant is through a criminal history, through the circumstances of the offense. Those are things within my control. And of course, Mr. Martin can argue for mitigation. However, the PSI does something a little bit different. It takes a neutral approach. It's a neutral party preparing that information. It's not biased. And it does go to the heart of the purpose of felony sentence, to protect the public and punish the offender. And the trial court needs as much information as possible. Would there be times where the state would waive and look the other way to allow a sentence of time served or a local residential sanction that's been served that's then imposed? Yeah, of course there would be. But I think at the heart of this case—
Did you just say there's times when the state would look the other way when a PSI was not done?
And be satisfied—
And go along with the sentence as contrary to law?
I would say that I'm sure we've done it, whether knowingly or not.
If they end up here, quite frankly, but yeah.
Well, I don't know, because the defendant would have to appeal then. So, I know that situation has occurred where we didn't recognize or didn't realize what was happening, or we didn't object to the sentence. Sometimes a $10 fine might be the appropriate sentence.
Well, here you
Sometimes
didn't object not to not having a PSI. The state did not object either case to the lack of a PSI.
No, the prosecutor, it was two different prosecutors at two different sentencings in this case. No, that particular objection was not made. However, I think the problem here is it's a mandatory duty on the part of the court. The court can't sentence in conformity with law unless if it, and I only go to Kalish because that's the only language that defines what is contrary to law.
Has House Bill 86 changed the impact of Kalish at all? There are some courts of appeals that are suggesting it has, and that, as you know, was a plurality opinion.
The 8th District in State versus Venus, V-E-N-E-S, has brought back and has looked at consecutive sentencing under the clear and convincing evidence standard to determine whether or not it's contrary to law. It doesn't go to the abuse of discretion standard of review because Kalish looked at, after we got rid of the findings, Foster's effect on the appellate standard of review of a sentence. And I think that contrary to law, regardless of the statutory language, really of the standard of review, really needs to be defined. What is contrary to law?
We have not yet defined it, even in Kalish. It was not we didn't have the votes to define it definitely, did we?
No, it was only three members of the court that stated that the definition that I'm relying upon for the ability to bring this appeal under 2953.08b2.
What you're saying is these sentences are void, not voidable.
Oh, God, jeez.
Is that right?
No, I am not.
Please say no.
I appealed within the 30 days, so I don't have to rely on a void argument to be before this court to challenge a sentence.
Counsel, I just want to clarify something that you just said, though, in terms of this case versus the Amos case. My understanding from the state's brief, and maybe I've missed something, but the state's position was there was an objection. It didn't say specifically that there was no PSI, but there was an objection.
Yes.
But are you saying now that was not an objection for purposes of what we might do with a harmless error analysis?
No, I'm not.
Okay, so you have not abandoned your position in Amos that there was, in fact, an objection.
There was an objection, but it wasn't specifically to the lack of a pre-sentence investigation report. The assistant prosecuting attorney in the room did not cite that as a reason.
Okay,
but we did object to the sentence at that
time.
Let's
say that we agree with Mr. Martin that a harmless error analysis should apply in these cases. Do we apply harmless error in Amos, or are you saying harmless error could never apply in the Amos case because there was an objection?
Yes. I agree with the latter statement. However, I don't think that this is a harmless error, plain error review. This is, if we look to what is contrary to law, if it wasn't legal, then it doesn't matter whether the state objected or
so
not.
So we would never get to the second prong, which would be under normal circumstances, abuse of discretion, because it doesn't pass the first prong.
Exactly. Right. And that's why I think that this court does need to resolve both these cases to determine truly what is the sentence that's contrary to law.
Should we send it back to the 8th District and give them the first opportunity to resolve these cases en banc, and then we wait to see what they come up with, and you gentlemen may be back here at some point?
I would love to come back in a year and a half and argue about this again, Your Honor. However, I would just
could you wait 3 years?
Not.
You'll be leaving at that point, Mr. Rubens.
That would be the 8th District's second chance to do so. I did ask
to en banc it, right, because they were asked in both cases to en banc it, and they didn't do it. But should this court, just as a matter of protocol, send it back and say you need meets the criteria for conflict, an inter-district conflict, and pursuant to our prior case, you need to resolve this. And then, depending on what they come up with, we may be back here.
I would enjoy a chance to argue this en banc again to the 8th District, and I think that's this court's decision. I think that this case does go beyond because it does implicate the entire standard of review and definition of what contrary to law means, because in these two cases, it just refers to Kalish. It doesn't define that, and as Mr. Martin pointed out, he thinks that because I didn't say no PSI, I can't be before this court. I believe I can under the Kalish standard. So I'd ask that this court affirm Richmond. However, in the other court, I did ask the other case a reversal. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Martin, you may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. In State versus Reynolds, this court said that the failure to allocute death penalty case did not require reversal of the death sentence where the defendant had made statements in mitigation prior to that. That particular procedural guarantee in that case did not rise to the level of the kind of error that the state of Ohio wants you to employ with respect to a PSI on an F5. I would suggest to you that undercuts the state's argument. You can't say that every procedural
mechanism in a sentencing rises to the level of automatic reversal when it's not followed. That's inconsistent with this court's jurisprudence on what it means to have review for error and the types of error that are preserved. With respect to the question about en banc review, since Mr. Regas agreed to it first, I don't have to wear the collar. I would agree that if this court, that an appropriate means of resolving this matter would be for this court to send it back to the 8th District for the en banc review as well. And in the event it does so, I would suggest to the court that the issue could be framed in the manner of the proposition of law that I have submitted in my brief, which notes the fact that there was no objection by the state of Ohio with respect to the PSI. And to the extent that I've taken up an awful lot of time to, at the end, say to you,
What is your preference, Mr. Martin, on that?
Since we'll get it back before 3 years, I would suggest to the court that sending it back for en banc review would be appropriate. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you call a recess?